from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On average, people in the U.S. consume 4.5 servings of red meat each week. That's despite the nutritional recommendation that cutting back on red meat and processed meats is good for your health. But that long-standing advice was challenged this week. A series of studies published in the Annals of Internal Medicine finds that there is no solid scientific evidence for advising people to change their meat-eating habits. The studies, which did not take into consideration the environmental impact of meat production or its effect on animal welfare, have called into question the way nutritional research is conducted. And we'll talk about the research and how it could affect nutritional guidelines. And we want to hear from you. Will this news change your eating habits? It's coming up next. After this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Scientists have long said that eating less red meat is healthier for the body and health, but a new study is challenging that widely held view. According to a number of studies published Monday in the Annals of Internal Medicine, any health benefits from reducing the consumption of beef and pork are small and don't warrant a shift in eating habits. This hour, we'll learn more about the controversial study, what it means for nutritional guidelines, and why some researchers are questioning the results. And joining us first is John Ioannidis. He's professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and co-directs the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. And professor, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good to have also Nisha Parikh, who's here with us in studio. She's associate professor of medicine, division of cardiology at UCSF. She also sees patients in the UCSF Cardiovascular Care and Prevention Center. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Christopher Gardner, who is also joining us here in studio. He's a nutrition scientist, professor of medicine at Stanford Prevention Research Center. Welcome, Christopher Gardner.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. And let me begin, if I may, with you, John Ioannidis. There is a real concern about this study, and it's obviously created a great deal of controversy, and studies seem to change constantly about what's good and bad, and keeping track of is really confusing for people. I mean, over the last couple of years, think about salt and fats and carbs, and we're going to get into a discussion about nutritional studies. But let me ask you first about your response to this study, and also, are people now sort of much more carte blanche to eat red meat and processed meats?
So I think that the papers that were published in the Annals of Internal Medicine were very well done. They were very rigorous, very cautious, and careful in their approach to appraising the evidence and trying to make some sense of what we know and what we don't know.
What do we know and what we don't know according to the studies?
It seems that the final conclusion probably focuses more on the fact that we don't know. And I think that this is where most of the controversy arises compared to other bodies that have tried to generate guidelines based on that evidence. If you look at the data and if you look at the results, probably the numbers are not really much different. There can be some controversy about what studies are included and how they're included and how they're synthesized. The big difference seems to be on what do people infer based on these numbers. So most of the previous efforts to generate guidelines have been more aggressive, telling people that you should cut back on meat consumption, red meat consumption, and even more so for processed red meat. These guidelines focus more on the fact that the evidence is of low quality, unavoidably to a large extent, and low certainty. And therefore, we can only make weak recommendations, and we cannot really tell you to cut back on what you eat for red meat and processed meat just on health reasons and just based on that evidence. So this is where the big controversy and the big debate arises. It's that inferential difference, the difference on what people make out of the same body of data.
Again, John Ioannidis is professor of medicine at Stanford School of Medicine and co-directs the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. And Christopher Gardner is here in studio, nutrition scientist, professor of medicine, also at Stanford, the Stanford Research Prevention Center. Professor Gardner, let me go to you on just the harsh criticism that's coming on about this study. The findings in the Journal of Internal Medicine, it's been excoriated by American Heart Association. In fact, past year called it fatally flawed. American Cancer Society, Harvard School of Public Health. You yourself, I think, found this bewildering and came out strongly against it and signed a petition, as I understand it, that says they should go back to the drawing boards.
I did. So, Michael, I have worked on making guidelines for the American Heart Association, making them from the American Diabetes Association for 18 years. I have taught Stanford undergraduates nutrition, and we always start out with Nutrition 101. How do we know what we know? And almost the first statement that comes out of my mouth is we're a little handicapped here because we really never get randomized controlled trials of morbidity and mortality. That's the highest level of evidence. That's the kind of thing where you say, okay, I really need to know this. So everybody keep everything else the same, but you 10,000 people avoid eggs and you 10,000 people eat a lot of eggs and we'll wait to see who lives or dies. That's never going to happen with that or red meat or broccoli or soy. So when I start my class or I work with these guidelines groups, we say, okay, let's start with those. How many randomized controlled trials do we have of life or death? Wow, almost none. How many do we have of moving blood pressure or blood cholesterol? Those are things that you can change in weeks. Turns out we have quite a few of those. Risk factor change doesn't necessarily mean you saved a life, but you would hope it would. The next step down is, well, you know, if you really wanted to see who lived or dies, there's some folks out there doing observational epidemiology. They tracked them for 30 years, and they know who lived or died, and they asked them what they ate. Association, not causation, but at least we know who lived or died, and we can see if that's plausible. Then we go to animal studies to see what happened in a rat. Then we go to a test tube and look at molecular and cell biology. And we say, okay, coming at this from five different angles, but not the gold standard, not the randomized controlled trial because we don't have it, what should we tell people to eat tomorrow? And it's consistently been less red meat because of the amount that the U.S. eats, and more vegetables, legumes, fruits, and grains because they're eating fewer than our recommendations of those. The balance is out of whack in the U.S. That makes these findings controversial.
And they are controversial indeed. Let me go to Nisha Parikh, who's again here with us in studio, Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Cardiology, UCSF. You yourself are a vegetarian, a vegan?
I'm a lifelong lacto-ovo-vegetarian, mostly, you know, was just raised that way.
Separate from your clinical practice.
I do. I actually do.
So what does the study mean to you as a practicing physician and cardiologist?
Well, I think my initial reaction is it probably confuses my patients more than it's helpful. That's sort of my initial reaction. When a patient comes to me and asks me what types of dietary modification they can make to improve their heart health, I think at the centerpiece of what I usually tell them is that increasing your fruits and vegetable intake is some of the best evidence we have that you're going to lower your blood pressure, for instance. We have really good randomized control trial data on that. There was a set of trials called the DASH diet done that was in a large population of men and women. And increasing your fruit and vegetable intake to about 5 or 6 servings a day and then adopting a low-fat diet, so dietary fat less than 6%, in these folks actually decreased their blood pressure materially. And in some folks got them off of some of their antihypertensive medicines. That's really what my patients are interested in. I think most people don't want to take a medicine and they want to see what they can do in their lifestyle to help their heart and their risk factors.
Well, if you have patients with high cholesterol, I think you tell them to go vegan. That often is not followed. In fact, I think preference might be for statins. There are too many patients probably taking statins thinking they can compensate for whatever the problem might be in terms of intake.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that our conversation usually starts with, look, doctor, what can I do in my lifestyle so I can come off the statin medicine? And for some of my patients, it won't be possible. A large proportion of my practice includes people that have coronary heart disease and they've had stents and bypass surgeries. And for them, I think a statin is really an extra insurance policy that things are going to be okay and we can prevent further heart attacks and heart disease. But in another, you know, large percentage of my population, they haven't yet experienced heart disease and they're looking at ways that they can lower their cholesterol, for instance, using diet and lifestyle. And for them, I am honest and upfront that I think that adopting a plant-based diet is really the thing that is going to. So I'm talking about a vegan diet that eliminates dairy and meat. That's really the only thing that's going to approximate a statin in terms of lowering their bad cholesterol level. But most of them, you are absolutely right, don't think it's something they can maintain. And that's a fine starting point. But I present the evidence the way I understand it. And then we go from there.
Well, as long as we're bringing up evidence again, let me go back to Professor Ioannidis. And John Ioannidis, there is a sense of some of these proclamations being made when perhaps there isn't enough in the way of findings or evidence to make us, well, at least feel that the evidence is there.
This is true. And I think that it's almost unavoidable that most of the designs that we're trying to use to study these questions of nutrition have inherent limitations that do not allow us to reach large certainty. It is not that we do not have rigorous randomized trials. Actually, the largest trial that might be pertinent to this particular question of meat consumption was done to a large extent at Stanford and other places, the Women's Health Initiative, and it really didn't show any difference between the two strategies, even though one might argue that, as Christopher said, many people crossed over and would not adhere to what was suggested. Maybe the results are still not possible to exclude some small benefit, and maybe there's other flaws in randomized trials. But most of the evidence that we have comes from observational studies, where you try to take care of differences that may exist between people who use different types of nutrition or different types of diet. And these people would be not the same. They would differ in many, many other aspects. So you try to think about what these aspects might be. In some cases, you may have ways that you can measure their differences in other sorts of behaviors or socioeconomic status or exercise or other profiles. Most of the time, we just cannot perfectly match those who eat something versus those who do not eat something. Then there's other inherent problems like nutrition is very difficult to measure. You know, it's very strong recall bias. Our measurement tools are not very sharp. There's loss to follow-up. There's a zillion problems that make the tools that we have too difficult to give conclusive answers. It's a little bit like staying at a distance of 100 yards from a house and asking, well, what do you see? I can see the windows. I can see the door. I can see probably a car that is parked outside. But if you ask me, can you see that fly that is flying in the living room? I cannot do that from 100 yards. And this is pretty much what our studies are trying to do, try to detecting flies that are flying in the living room from 100 yards. And they cannot do that. So it's a struggle, and we don't want to leave people with ambivalence and ambiguity and confusion. And I think that there's every good intention to try to give the best advice. But I think what the Annals papers are trying to do is to add a sense of modesty about the certainty or lack of certainty that we have about much of the evidence in nutrition.
Well, Christopher Gardner, people are confused. I mean, that is a fact now, particularly when they get all this information that doesn't necessarily square and that often goes against itself. And I'm just concerned with the argument that I hear that these kinds of studies are valid when I think about, for example, the fact that people may eat a burger every day, but they may also eat it with French fries and a Coke. So you don't necessarily know about the intake. And I'm also thinking about the fact that you can't have one control group just eating burgers or meat and another control group for a long period of time not eating any meat and necessarily compare them. There's problems with observational studies here, I think, isn't there?
There are, but we do have randomized controls, control trials of risk factors, as Nisha said. So, you know, one of the big deals is lipids and LDL cholesterol and saturated fats. So just as a whole other area of cardiology, and you should feel free to chime in here if you want. So a cardiologist that I work with at Stanford has a standard short food frequency questionnaire when they come in, say, what are you eating? It's not a really long thing. And they ask about meat. They ask about ice cream and butter and some other things. One recent patient had an LDL cholesterol in the hundreds until they started trying to go paleo. They were eating a lot of meat, a lot of butter, and a lot of ice cream.
But help the consumer navigate through a lot of these. I mean, there's conflicting messages, as I said, from food studies. Eggs are bad, but then they're good. Fat is bad, then it's good.
Wait, let me finish this one example, and I will go back to that. So then they said, look, how about lowering your meat and your butter and your ice cream? The LDL had gone up to the 200s and 300s in this patient, and then when they followed the instructions and lowered it, it went back to the 100s. So it's actually clinical practice to support following the guidelines in treating patients. So that's hard evidence right there. So to get at what you were saying just there, so let's talk, and please cut me off if this takes too long because nutrition is complex. I think there's three layers that are responsible for nutrition being confusing. There's nutrients, foods, and there's food patterns. So if we look at saturated fat or fiber, saturated fat bad, fiber good. Not really. What if you put fiber in a Coke? Does that mean Coke is good? What if you say saturated fat is in whole dairy and you have skim milk? Are you sure that's good? Wait, now we're talking about foods. Okay, well, you should eat a lot of broccoli. So, okay, good, I only ate broccoli. No, I didn't mean only broccoli. And you should avoid this thing, okay? I completely avoided it and had a lot of other crap. And I'm not healthier. Well, you can't just avoid the one thing. You got to do this as a set. So the interesting thing where nutrition has moved, Michael, lately is food patterns.
Remember all the trouble George Bush Sr. had when he said, I hate broccoli? I mean, people take these things very seriously.
They do. So think about food patterns. So really, a really nice thing that the Dietary Guidelines Group did in 2015 is for the first time after updating these every 5 years, they changed the way they framed the dietary guidelines into shifts. So when you eat less red meat, if you are following the guidelines, think about what you shifted to. Did you now have more pizza that was refined grain with high-salt tomato sauce with processed cheese on it? Or did you have chicken? Or did you have tofu? Or did you have salad? So what did you shift to? So if you have less of one thing and you switch to something else that's just as bad, I mean, it's amazing. Americans seem to be obsessed with exploring every possible lousy way to eat. They're incredibly creative at this when, in fact, eventually, they should get the message that we weren't asking them to shift from one bad thing to another. We wanted them to shift from this to that. And that's a lot of where the message gets confusing. So we didn't take the shift into account. Neither do these guidelines. They just compared high meat to low meat.
Well, you're the guy who essentially establishes a lot of these guidelines. So, you know, it's a great value to hear what you have to say about this and also to hear what Dr. Ioannidis has to say. But as we see, there's some conflict and some differences to be sure. I want to give out the phone number, and I'd like our listeners to join us if you have some thoughts about this, if you have questions. Will this study change your meat eating habits is the big question, I suppose. Why or why not? But you can give us a call now, and I invite you to do that at our toll-free number. Number to call is 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. You can also be part of the program by getting in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have or comments to forum@kqed.org. And if I go back to Nisha Parikh, who again is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Cardiology at UCSF, let's talk about diet in general with you. The keto diets do include meat.
Oh, yeah, that's been a question I get a decent amount in my practice now, especially from my younger patients who are looking to prevent heart disease and lose weight. I think I probably get an equal number question about plant-based diets as well. But with respects to the keto diet and also other popular diets that are similar, the paleo diet for one, you know, I usually sort of probe with my patient, what's your goal? If their goal is weight loss and they've tried other things and they want to go ahead and try this, then I work with them. We don't have a lot of long-term studies on the keto diet in particular. So although I know that it does lead to weight loss and for some people very sustained weight loss, and I think that's a positive benefit, I want to make sure that their risk factors are well controlled. So if they're embarking upon it, then I'm sure to follow their weight and their lipids And then again, if their lipids are in a range that are too high, I'll still suggest a medicine regardless of their weight.
And if their blood pressure is too high, a lot of fruits and vegetables, right?
A lot of fruits and vegetables, lowering salt intake, moderating alcohol, exercising. So it's things that we all know are good for us, but they actually do make a difference with blood pressure.
And let's get back to evidence. Christopher Gardner, I'm going to go to you on this again. The studies always seem to bring up the question of just how hard the evidence is. And you and Dr. Ioannidis have been certainly enlightening on this. But the fact of the matter is that can we really get, you know, the gold standard here? That's what we always hear about real evidence and the top drawer evidence.
So part of this depends on what grading criteria you use. So the ones they used in that meta-analysis was called GRADE. It's pretty much developed for pharmaceutical type trials where you can have a placebo and an active arm.
But even that's been questioned because it was developed, wasn't it, from drug trials?
That is my main point. So an alternate one is called HELM. It's called Hierarchical Evidence for Lifestyle Medicine. And so that takes into account that we really aren't going to have randomized controlled trials in diet. So we throw up our arms and say, oh, the house is 100 feet away. Go ahead and eat whatever you want. I can't see where the window or the door is. So just, you know, take a shot and walk toward that. No, no, no. We have a lot of evidence. We just don't have the randomized controlled trials. There's another thing called the Bradford Hill criteria, which took into account lifestyle issues. We're not going to have randomized controls of sun exposure or physical activity. There's no randomized controls of jumping out of a plane without a parachute. But we all know that you should jump out of a plane without a parachute, despite no randomized controlled trials. So some of this is common sense.
And a lot of it is common sense. And let me go back to you, if I may, Dr. Ioannidis. What are we talking about here in terms of, the study possibly? Actually, what I really want to ask you is, what do you recommend people do to navigate these nutritional guidelines?
So this will remain a debated issue no matter what. But I think that common sense can be interpreted in different ways. Most of the risks that are involved in single nutrients or single simple modifications in food are nowhere close to the risks of falling without a parachute or some other risk that we are fully aware in public health, like tobacco. For example, smoking increases the risk of cancer about 20-fold. Red meat may increase the risk of cancer about 1.02-fold. So we're talking about a 1,000-fold difference here. When you translate that to a population level, to billions of people who need to make that decision, we could still be talking about several thousands of lives being at stake. So we shouldn't really just throw out the baby with the bathwater. At the same time, I think that trying to infer that nutrition is so different from other types of science that it needs its own set of guidelines that allow it to reach high certainty no matter what in the absence of rigorous experimental evidence, I think I have some concerns about that. It creates a very different set of rules. It kind of says that we have a different scientific method when it comes to nutrition as compared to other interventions. GRADE has been applied to any type of intervention, not just medications, although obviously medications are probably the core of the applications that have happened to date. So much of the battle is being fought around what level of certainty can we convey. And
on that note, I'm going to have to interrupt because we are coming up on a break, and I want to again invite our listeners to join us at our toll-free number. You can do that now at 866-733-6786 or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Again, we're talking about new red meat study, confusing consumers but exposing flaws in nutritional research, and just how valid is this study, and what are you doing about eating meat or not eating meat? We'll return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a new red meat study that, is pretty confusing to consumers. It's exposing flaws in nutritional research as well, and we have a panel with us. Christopher Gardner's here in studio with us, nutrition scientist and professor of medicine at Stanford Prevention Research Center, and Nisha Parikh, who is associate professor of medicine, Division of Cardiology at UCSF, and with us by phone is Professor John Ioannidis, who is professor of medicine at Stanford School of Medicine. He co-directs the Meta Research Innovation Center, the Metric Center at Stanford. And I should say, just out of a sense of concern about any discussion that involves red meat, environmental degradation is not part of this discussion, but there is that with red meat. There's also concern, obviously, about animal welfare and industrial farming. We're just focusing on dietary and nutrition facts and what we know and what we don't know. And there's also, I should say, that livestock production accounts for about 14.5% of greenhouse gas, not to mention, well, all that methane from beef, and about five times climate impact of chicken or pork, of other things that we think of when we think of what we digest or what we ingest. I also want to read a comment by a listener, Joe, who may be reflecting some of the feeling many of you have. He writes, "Nutritionists have often given us bad advice in the past that I am tired of them telling me what to eat. Milk is bad, eggs are bad, red meat is bad. Then after I have limited these products in my diet, I find that fat may not be bad and that cholesterol from eggs is not the cause of heart problems. Instead, it's sugar. Happiness to me at this point in my life will probably increase my lifespan more than limiting these foods." Let me go to you, if I could, on this, Dr. Parikh. And let me also ask you, if I may, about heredity in all this, because certainly it plays a major factor in terms of heart care. And so how does that square with what the study is telling us, what any of these studies are telling us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to the comment from the listener, and also, you know, we'll address your point as well. But I think it sort of drives home the point that when we give blanket advice about one particular food group to patients, it often causes confusion because we'll have studies that come out inevitably in favor or against that one particular food group. So it probably doesn't make sense to do that. But on the whole, I think our evidence shows us that increasing the, you know, your plant-based sources of nutrients is a good thing. And that's a good thing for your heart, and it's a good thing to prevent cancer as well.
Just read Michael Pollan. I mean, he's, says it all.
And with respect to your question, which was really more about genetics, there is certainly a subset of the population that that is predisposed to having high lipids and heart disease. And in those folks, we're a lot more aggressive. So we really don't wait and experiment as much in that group. I generally would start a statin. In the meanwhile, they can change their lifestyle as well, and we're certainly a lot more aggressive with those folks. But for the vast majority of people, usually you can empower yourself to change your diet, to change your sedentary behavior and start exercising, and that will improve your lipid profile, your blood pressure. It'll improve your predisposition to developing diabetes. And those are really the major risk factors for developing heart disease.
So. And it's a great public service message that people always have to be mindful of. And Chris Gardner is raising his hand here like he's in my classroom. Chris, go ahead.
So I want to give a shout out to Nisha. So when you were first asking her about this and what she told her patients, she didn't say avoid red meat. She said, "I asked them to eat more veggies and fruits." And so one approach is not a deprivation approach of what not to do. It's what to do. And if you've eaten a lot of those veggies and fruits, then the amount of meat you have might be less, because you're already kind of full. And then the next challenge becomes, well, I'm not sure I like vegetables that much. And I got to tell you how coincidental this is. So there's a publication in Psychological Science today that came out from Stanford University, the Culinary Institute of America, and five other dining halls where they reframed vegetables in the dining halls by giving them indulgent names and doing a fabulous job cooking them. And they showed a 25% increase in choosing vegetables across multiple universities. So it's really a joy part. We got to bring the joy and pleasure and taste-backed food. So I totally relate to what your first listener said. Let's not be deprivation-oriented. Let's celebrate food and be joyful. And you can actually hit all these things at the same time. Joy, pleasure, veggies, animal rights and welfare, global warming. Man, there's a savory spot right in the middle of all those.
And I wonder, John Ioannidis, what you say to another listener, and I'm going to go to calls right after this. Amir says, "Meat has been part of the natural human diet forever. Why do nutritionists keep advocating for sugary fruits and carb-full grains all the time? Don't we see the epidemic of diabetes causing people to be scared from fat and meat?"
So I think that we're facing major problems and major challenges. As you say, we have an epidemic, a pandemic of diabetes. We have an epidemic, a pandemic of obesity. It's not really getting any better. Things are getting worse around the globe. We have more people who will suffer multiple diseases for which obesity and diabetes is placing them at increased risk of, and also a highly increased death risk. So we're struggling to make progress and to make the best advice. And when it comes to nutrition, it's not easy. I think that what you hear from all of us is that we're struggling to come up with solutions that would not sound as depriving people or forcing people to do things that are abominable or they cannot tolerate or they cannot stay on board with us when we propose them. And I think that we have a lot of way to go trying to find the right attachments of information that will convince people. For example, environmental impact may be a stronger argument if we really buttress it with strong data compared to just telling people that if you change that particular nutrient, you're going to live longer, which has a lot of uncertainty if you focus on that very narrow nutrient per se.
Well, we saw a lot of change when data came out about secondhand smoke and people became ashamed of smoking, and it really did have an effect. And I think probably the concerns about the environment have had a good deal of effect also on people who may be abstemious when it comes to meat or more so. Let me bring in our callers, and we begin, Christina, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So we have a 16-month-old toddler, and my question is really around nutrition for toddlers or young children. Right now, we try to do a good mix of meat, dairy, fats, fruits, veggies, but it's such a stressful thing for us as new parents. And I'm just wondering if you have any comments around, you know, what to feed children, because we obviously want to instill some really healthy eating habits for the baby.
Well, we'll go to Professor Gardner again on this. Chris Gardner.
So you really need a pediatric nutrition for that, especially at that age, because young kids are so picky. But I encourage you to give them a variety of foods. We have food allergy issues. You know, how early do you expose them to peanuts? Kari Nadeau at Stanford does a great job with that. I think what you're going to find, because I have four boys, is they're going to eat something and have a great time with it, and then all of a sudden they won't swallow it and they'll spit it back out, and you're going to have to try something else. So I encourage you to try the variety that you are.
I think it's good advice. And Christina, I thank you. Do you want to add something here, John Ioannidis? Professor Ioannidis?
No, I think that what Christopher replied is very sound advice. And I think that it's even more important when it comes to offering nutritional advice for children, because if things get wrong very early on, we have evidence that they have a trajectory that follows people in their adult life.
And here's a comment from David from a tweet. He says, and I mentioned environment was not necessarily part of the discussion, but I think he points out something valuable here. He says, we can't have these discussions without thinking of the holistic impacts and risks of red meat. Remember the Amazon? Intersectionality demands we consider all the reasons not to eat beef, including the climate, diversity, and land rights problems with cattle. And here's another caller. Stephen, join us. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm curious who paid for this study. And number one, I mean, was it the American Beef Council, the American Pork Council? And number two, your guests have very well articulated that it's common sense. I'm going to listen to a cardiologist far more like your guest than I am, you know, somebody who's conducted a study. And again, what about, how does genetics come into this? What kind of blood type do you have?
And, good questions all. In fact,
my answer off the air.
Yeah, we were raising that with you, Dr. Parikh, about the role of cholesterol in all this. But anybody know about this? Bradley Johnson led this study. He also has published other studies in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Is he getting funded by the cattlemen or anything? Do we know anything?
So I can tell you. So I was asked to review the papers before the embargo lifted. And keep in mind, this is not one paper. This is six papers that they published in Annals. The same
internationally, in fact,
at the
as
same
I said
time.
Before, yeah.
I've actually never seen anything like this. And so when a reporter said, "Will you review it and talk to me tonight?" I said, "Sure." She sent me nine PDFs. One of the PDFs, interestingly, was the conflict of interest statement of every one of the 17 authors, however many they were, because they foresaw that criticism. So according to their conflicts of interest, they have none. 2 years ago, the same group said there's no clear evidence that sugar is bad for us, so we should keep eating sugar at the same amount that we are right now. That particular one was funded by ILSI, which is the International Life Science Institute, and that does have some connections to big food. So I haven't seen big connections to cattle, but in the past, this group has done that. I think this one, they tried really hard to be squeaky clean. It's hard to say for sure. So many authors, but they did present clean conflicts of interest statements to the journal.
And here's another caller, Vijaya. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead, please.
My comment is, I think I'm a dietitian, and I know Chris. I think they're trying to find a magic bullet with nutrition, and there is no magic bullet. As long as we enjoy what we eat and we eat it in moderation, and I blame media for popularizing one over the other.
I think we lost that call, but I thank you for it. And Nisha Parikh, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, thank you for calling. You know, I wanted to make the point that I think getting help from a dietitian in our practice has been incredibly important. You know, our particular dietitian has been a great addition to our team. I have a limited amount of time, of course, to spend with patients, and some of it's, sort of going to be concentrated on pharmacotherapy. So having somebody that's really thinking about lifestyle change in terms of a patient's entire context is really important. So, and that context includes things like stress, sleep, access to healthy food, barriers to wanting to eat in a more healthy way, hunger, and thinking about, you know, those types of things in relation to the other things I mentioned are really important. So I just wanted to make that point.
I'm glad you did. And since you mentioned hunger, there's a listener named Larry who's bringing up socioeconomic factors here. A lot of people are hungry. A lot of people are eating a lot of fast food because they can't necessarily afford to eat other food.
Yeah, you know, that's
part of the picture, really.
It's absolutely part of the picture. It is true that many of the people at highest risk for cardiovascular disease are also those that have low socioeconomic status and oftentimes live in food, what we call food deserts. So believe it or not, in America, there are food deserts. There are places right around us that do not have a large quantity of healthy foods available, these fresh fruits and vegetables we're talking about. So that's something we have to keep in mind as well. I recently came across an advertisement that I think one of the fast food establishments, it might be Taco Bell, has a whole new plant-based menu, which was so interesting. Having grown up a lacto-ovo vegetarian, I can tell you that even 10 or 20 years ago, you know, that wasn't on our landscape at all. So I think things are changing. And I think that access to healthy food is becoming more widespread, and that's a good thing.
Here's Pamela, who writes, do people think science is static? A study is done, the answer is found, and the matter is closed. Let's educate our populace on how science works, and that knowledge is always being developed, refined, and reviewed. And when we go to more of your calls, we go next to, is it Han? Han, join us, please.
Hey there, it's Mahan. I just wanted to see if there's any material difference between the traditional sort of grain-fed or corn-fed cattle and, I guess, more modernly marketed grass-fed, grass-finished cattle. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, it's a good question, Professor Ioannidis. Can we get some light on this from you?
I think that it would be unwise to say that we have evidence that could really answer this kind of second or third level question, when we have little evidence to answer even the more major issues around meat consumption. So I think that there's some big issues about where meat is produced and where it's consumed, for example, and this applies to all food. You know, if you can grow food and produce food locally rather than have to transport it, that makes a huge difference. There's big issues about what food you consume and how much you just leave aside, how much left over is there. These issues collectively may have a much bigger bearing compared to the subtle technicalities of how exactly we produce different types of food. Although I think that we need more research to understand what are optimal practices both for health reasons, but also for environmental and other perspectives.
Yeah, I want to go to Christopher Gardner again. I know you have something to add here, Chris, but what about, we haven't even talked about processed meat. Can I get you to weigh in on that?
Can I answer the listener's call first? Because that wasn't really quite addressed. So if you go to grass-fed meat, they tend to have more omega-3s. We're not really sure how great omega-3s are. If you go to the corn and soy fed, that tends to be in a concentrated animal feeding operation, a CAFO, and they're grown so tightly that they're given antibiotics in their feed daily, which is sort of contributing to superbugs. And so, yeah, there's a big difference between grass-fed and corn and soy-fed, and we don't really have time to get into it now. But
We've done programs on that. They're in our archives.
Okay, yeah. Moving to processed, yeah, that's another fascinating question. So when you look at the evidence, when the folks have come down on, including cancer in particular, they really came down more on processed meat than on unprocessed meat. And so on some of these deli slices and the things that are cured and they have a less sodium in them, if you look through the meta-analysis that just got published, they didn't have enough studies that tease those two apart. But in the guidelines literature, where we try to take into account everything, including the extra sodium or some of the things that you're eating with these processed meat slices, they generally come down harder on them and ask for greater reduction of those. Is there perfect randomized control evidence? No. Is there common sense evidence if you put five different angles together? Yes.
Since Chris mentioned sodium, Nisha Parikh, I have to tell you, I eat a lot of turkey, and now I get turkey which is unsalted, and I'm thinking it probably makes a great deal of difference in terms of my heart care.
Yeah, sodium is one of those things that I think gets a little bit overlooked. It's true that if you keep your sodium intake under 2 grams a day, and if you want to be even more more strict and get a better bang for your buck for blood pressure and other things than less than 1.5 grams per day, then you'll have a materially lower blood pressure, and that will affect your that can protect you against heart disease. For women, hypertension is really the number one risk factor for heart failure, which is, you know, one of the big conditions we worry about. So I think that that watching your sodium intake vis-a-vis reducing the amount of processed food that you consume, or, you know, salted meat can be really helpful.
And the fact of the matter is, if you eat in restaurants, almost all restaurants add a lot of salt.
Absolutely. That's why their food tastes so good.
Let me go to some more calls here. Padma joins us next. Padma, you're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about fats. Good fats, bad fats. Now, Dean Ornish, in his study, both on prostate cancer and heart reversal, said total fats of 10 grams. Caldwell Esselstyn in Cleveland Clinic says the fats from your vegetables is enough. You don't even need to take nuts. But then what about good fats? I thought more good fats is good. If you're not trying to lose weight, olive oil and good fats are good for you. So where do we stand?
Well, it's an important question. I'm going to go to Christopher again. Christopher Gardner?
Yeah,
good fat, bad fat.
Yeah, it's really not even good fat, bad fat. It's food. Are you eating avocados? Are you eating nuts and seeds? I think we really get in trouble when we focus on a nutrient, because you can pull it in or pull it out of a processed food. If you're talking about avocados, nuts and seeds and some olive oil on a salad, most of us are sort of leaning more Mediterranean or flexitarian these days. And the flip side of that isn't the oil. If you're not having oil, how do people really do it? They eat a lot of raw veggies? No, they actually get a more white flour, more added sugar, because it was low fat. We actually seen that in one of our studies. We pushed people to be super, super low fat. They couldn't maintain it. And as they cheated, what they added back was refined grain and added sugar, which is horrible.
Let me thank Padma for the call. I want to go right to another caller, and that's you, Imran. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, Michael. I was listening to this talk you guys are doing, and I think that it's more about binge eating. It's uncontrollable, you know, because there's this desires of not just meat, but like overall carbohydrates and stuff, and also lack of exercise. Because that's the stuff that now you see all over the place. Everybody's just sitting down and watching TV, and you just have a plate in front of you, and then you have no idea where you're at, and you're just knocked into sleep, you know? So
you're bringing up the whole picture here, and it is indeed the whole picture. And let me go back, if I may, to you, Nisha Parikh. You were talking about exercise before. What do you recommend to your patients in the way of exercise? We're talking about healthcare here.
Sure. Thank you, Imran, for those comments, because that's really the reality for a lot of patients. Is it's not really one food that you're worried about. It's really your entire picture, diet and exercise together. And in terms of exercise, I think that the American Heart Association are really the guidelines that I follow, which are, you know, to get I'd say 150 minutes of exercise per week, and you can split that up in various ways in terms of aerobic activity versus more weight-bearing exercise. But sometimes when folks are embarking upon a lifestyle change, I've found that it's useful to focus on one thing at a time. So first, I like to sort of get their dietary modification in place. And then once we sort of have a handle on that, we start to work on exercise. Because I think if we try to do too many things at once, then we're sort of setting ourselves up for failure. And then in terms of the binging and hunger issue, you know, that sort of ties in, I think, to the healthy fat question. Because if one is taking in a carbohydrate, then it's true that if you eat concurrently a fat or a protein, it usually slows the release of sugar in the bloodstream, and it can actually help you not be hungry. And so, you know, there are things like that that we can work on, and our dietitian works on, that can be really helpful for patients as they embark upon a lifestyle change.
When the question came up before, John Ioannidis, about who was funding the studies and so forth, Christopher Gardner said it was pretty squeaky clean and all, but there was at least one researcher who was not in the study, but who's been widely quoted. I don't know if you know him, David Allison, public health at Indiana. He's a dean, actually, of public health at Indiana University. He's also part of the National Cattlemen's Association, and I just wonder about those kind of spokespeople, what you have to say about them.
So I think that there will be different opinions, as we said from the very beginning, and I have great respect for David Allison. Actually, he has invited me to give a lecture today in his institution. I think it's important to hear different viewpoints and at the same time don't miss the big picture. The big picture is that we're dealing with serious public health problems. Diet is very important. Obesity is a major risk factor. Telling people that if they eat more, they will be more likely to become obese, and if they eat less, they're less likely to be obese. Trying to improve the quality of their food and trying to incorporate other health behaviors related to exercise, quitting smoking, less stress, sleeping well. You know, it all comes together in a bundle, and I think that they should not be discouraged if they hear that experts now and then may disagree on trivia or minutia or details. I think that there's plenty of room to improve your health.
Should we end these observational studies? Should they come to an end in your judgment?
Well, judgment is something that is part of human thinking. So provided that...
Well, I ask the question because there's so much criticism and they're not necessarily gold standard, as I said earlier.
Yeah, I think that aiming to have gold standards for everything may be utopian. I think that we need to act, sometimes act on limited evidence, and just acknowledge that we have these limitations. We may have bronze standards or silver standards.
Again, John Ioannidis is professor of medicine at Stanford School of Medicine. Let me read a comment from Vineeth, who says, the best guideline to follow, I feel, is to look at your parents and relatives. They have either got it right or wrong, and it is more likely that their experience is more applicable to you than any study. Sad to say, but it appears research proves what it sets out to prove. And another listener writes, I was recently diagnosed with pretty advanced arthritis in my spine. My rheumatologist strongly recommended that I forego meat because meat can cause inflammation in the body. What do your experts today have to say about that? Anybody want to weigh in here, Dr. Parikh?
Well, it's probably not my area. I couldn't make a strong comment about arthritis.
You're a heart doctor, right? But what about meat and inflammation, Professor Gardner?
So, I mean, that's sort of one of the side topics that has come up recently. A guy named Stan Hazen at the Cleveland Clinic found this thing, TMAO, trimethylamine oxide. He looked at carnivores versus vegetarians. He fed people meat. He fed vegetarians meat. He did all kinds of things. TMO is sort of one of these inflammatory marker type things that we can look at in the blood. The problem is I just finished a study and looked at a set of 270 different inflammatory markers. And so if you're going to say, oh, how high is your inflammation? So let me go back to Nisha or somebody. So I guess as a clinician, you probably ask for a glucose and a lipid panel and a blood pressure. What do you ask for inflammation? And what do you tell your patients as to whether they're in or out of CRP range? Is that the only thing that you would do?
That's the only inflammation marker I measure routinely.
And you recognize there are hundreds, and we haven't really picked. I mean, there's some people who don't like CRP as a marker of inflammation. So inflammation is hugely important. We sort of all agree that...
What's CRP again?
C-reactive protein.
Okay.
Inflammation being really an underlying cause of all chronic degenerative disease. It goes to cancer, heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. We don't have a handle on, Christopher, I measured your level of inflammation today, and it's 7, and it really needs to be 5, so do this. We don't have that yet. There's actually a guy, Mark Davis at Stanford, who's created the Human Immune Monitoring Core, and one of his goals is actually to have an immune profile number that a clinician would ask for, and he's actually making some fabulous progress, but not there yet.
So the final question I'm going to ask of you and, well, of all of you is, do the risks warrant a shift in eating habits at this point from what we've learned from these studies?
Yes. Let me jump in quickly. So absolutely every group that I work with says, you know, we're not following the guide. We have guidelines and people don't follow them. Our health compared to other countries is worse. Our diet compared to other countries is worse. You can start connecting all the arrows and there's a lot of room for improvement. I would actually say it's not so much around meat. I would say it's back to the sugar and refined grain thing. About 33% of our calories come from those. And they're
glad you added that. Let me go to Dr. Ioannidis on this. Eat differently now, Dr. Ioannidis?
I would say that people should individualize their decision. They should see what they do, where they stand in the curve. You know, some of them may be just consuming too much meat. Others may be already vegans. They should also see what their alternatives are.
And Dr. Parikh?
There's some bigger considerations like environment, for example, or animal welfare.
I would say add fruits and vegetables to your diet in a larger amount than you're eating. Half your plate should be fruits and vegetables. We have very good evidence surrounding that.
And this has been a very good hour. I thank you all. Lots of advice. Thank our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.